South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, February 4th, 2019. Opposition forces are preparing to head up to a cantonment site.
There, I think donors are looking very hard at what are the government itself willing to do and that they use government revenue in a transparent and accountable manner to support implementation of the peace agreement.
And a senior military officer appeared in court today in South Sudan.
One of the charges is Section 69 in the SPLA Act 2019, that is the disobedience of standing orders. And then again, Section 67, that is disobedience of lawful orders.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The rebels of the SPLA-IO say it will start sending its first barge of 3,000-plus soldiers to South Sudan's cantonment site by this week. The SPLA-IO and other opposition forces and government troops are expected to assemble a jointly trained in Yei River State's Payam of Kindele to eventually become one united national army. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this story for VOA from Juba.
SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampol Gabriel and a member of the Joint Defense Board, the body responsible for implementing security arrangements, as he stated in the revitalized peace deal, confirmed the parties have agreed to officially open the first cantonment site next Sunday.
Immediately on the 10th, we are going to start with Kindele, then this month. So we'll go to Kindele, that is in Panyume. Yeah, we'll go to Kindele and establish the cantonment site. The forces on the ground have already been ordered to prepare to move into the cantonment site. And JNCC and JTSC have been instructed by the leadership of JDB to go on the ground. And citizens also will be requested to escort the team on the ground so that at least we are able to start that cantonment officially.
Gabriel says after months-long discussions on cantonment sites, the Joint Defense Board has agreed the SPLA-IO will send nearly 4,000 combat troops to be trained to protect civilians and politicians once a new government of national unity is formed in May.
We agreed that cantonment site for the opposition will be divided into two phases. We have phase one and phase two. Phase one will have 25 cantonment sites divided across all the region separately, and it is here in the agreement. We will have the copy later. Then the phase two will have 15 remaining cantonment sites will be established.
Aside from the pilot cantonment sites in Kindele of Yei River Estates, Morobo County, there are proposed cantonment sites in former Unity Estate, former Eastern Equatoria, former Jongole, former Western Equatoria, former Central Equatoria, former Western Barghazal, and former Northern Barghazal estates. Gabriel says the Ugandan and Sudanese government will support the training of the joint forces. He says he believes the soldiers do not require extensive training, but must learn how to work with and protect civilians. The parties have repeatedly called for funding from the international community to implement the peace deal. South Sudan's partners have yet to make their pledges. Lars Anderson, the Norwegian ambassador to South Sudan, says the government must first use its resources to fully implement the deal.
We have asked the government and to do what it can to come up with resources to fund the implementation of the peace agreement. There, I think donors are looking very hard at what are the government itself willing to do and that they use government revenue in a transparent and accountable manner to support implementation of the peace agreement. I think that is what everybody expects them to do.
The South Sudan government says it has allocated $1.4 million to the National Pre-Transitional Committee for implementing the revised agreement. Observers and critics say that amount is not sufficient. Gabriel says whether or not there is enough money to train and maintain the forces, the SPLA-IO will assemble its forces at the pilot cantonment site. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A South Sudanese military court today began hearing a case of a general accused of what the court calls disobeying standing military orders. Major General Stephen Bwai, Rol Nyang, a former commander of South Sudan's People's Defense Force 5th Division in Wau, was arrested in Mayom in May of last year and airlifted to Juba. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Major General Stephen Boy Rol Nyang is being court-martialed by a 7-member military panel led by a major general. Before Boy was transferred to Juba last year, he was arrested for defying military orders, according to Army Deputy Spokesman Brigadier General Santo Domingue.
One of the charges is actually Section 69 in the SSPLA Act 2019. That is disobedience of standing orders. And then again, Section 67, that is disobedience of lawful orders. And Section 60, that is treason. Section 61, offenses related to insecurity.
According to Domingue, violating a standing order is when an officer is transferred to another location for operations and the officer refuses to abide by the directive. He says violating a lawful order is when the military general recalls an officer to report to headquarters and the officer refuses to abide by the order. Domingue defines treason as when an officer decides to go against the orders of the state or the military. Boy was the commander of the then SPLS 5th Infantry Division in Wau in 2018. Domingue says while in Wau, Boy was ordered to report to Juba but defied the military directive and instead decided on his own to move to Mayom. Boy is the first high-ranking military officer to be tried for violating South Sudanese army laws and treason since the outbreak of the 2013 conflict. Domingue says Boy's trial is a normal disciplinary measure within the army in accordance with the SPLA Act 2009.
Well, it is a prerogative of the commander-in-chief and the CDF of the army to see into that justice must be done in cases related to insecurity. I think it doesn't have any implication with the current revitalized peace agreement.
At the start of today's military court hearing at Giada, the defense rejected the makeup of the general court-martial handling Boy's case, saying it was wrongly constituted and consists of junior officers, arguing it should be comprised of more senior officers than the accused. Defense lawyer Philip Anyang says the panel should have been formed by President Salva Kiir, the commander-in-chief of the South Sudan's armed forces, not the chief of defense forces.
The members of the panel are being headed by Major General, who is also the senior rank with the accused person. The law is very clear that the person who should head a tribunal or a special court like this should be someone of a higher rank. In this case, a lieutenant general. So we've insisted that the court gives us objects and the court goes back to consider itself well.
Anyang says his team will not compromise on any procedural issues that infringe on the rights of his client. He refused to say whether Boy was guilty of the charges brought against him, saying the defense will wait to see if the court is able to prove that Major General Boy is guilty of treason and the other assorted charges he faces. The court hearing has been adjourned until next Thursday. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
We now move to Ivory Coast, where supporters of former President Laurent Gbagbo say they cannot understand why the International Criminal Court would not allow Gbagbo to return to Ivory Coast following his acquittal. The ICC acquitted Gbagbo and Charles Blaise Gode last month for alleged crime against humanity and ordered their immediate release. But prosecutors challenged that decision, saying the pair might flee if their acquittal is overturned. Last weekend, Belgium agreed to host Gbagbo pending the outcome of a possible appeal. Jean-Gervais Tshitede is an official of Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front. He tells my colleague James Batty, Gbagbo should be allowed to return home.
To wait for the prosecutor to make his appeal. But we are not that happy because normally somebody who has been acquitted is supposed to be totally free.
What do you think the prosecutors are not allowing the former president to come back to Ivory Coast?
Well, we don't know why the prosecutor is taking this way. But one thing I can tell you that in Cote d'Ivoire, we as the supporters of Mr. Gbagbo and in the large extent all the Ivorian people, we are very, very happy about the acquittal of Mr. Gbagbo. Don't forget, let us remember that Mr. Gbagbo was accused of crime against humanity, which is the worst crime that a man can commit. It was a disgrace upon him, upon his family, upon his party, and upon his country. And after 7 years of procedure, after 2 years of trial, where 82 people went to the court to testify, the court has come to the conclusion that Mr. Gbagbo has done nothing, and he is acquitted. So we are very happy. Now, we see that the prosecutor is still trying to keep him, and he is about to make an appeal about his acquittal. Now, we are waiting for that, but we know that there's nothing new which can come up as an evidence to show that Mr. Gbagbo is guilty of anything.
Could it be related to the former president's wife, Simone? Was she wanted by the ICC, and now Ivory Coast probably doesn't want to turn her over to the ICC? Could it be because of that they are not allowing him to come back?
Well, I don't know, but I don't think there's a link between the two situations, because the ICC, it is an international jurisdiction, so they have all the means to make somebody go to The Hague when they want. Now, for Mr. Gbagbo, the procedure has come to its end as far as we are concerned. But for me, there's no relation. We cannot relate that to Mrs. Gbagbo's case.
But so let me ask this way. Could it be related to the 2020 presidential elections?
Well, we don't know. We know that normally the ICCC is not supposed to be concerned with what is going on in the political field in a country. Their role is to judge criminals or supposed to be criminals when the country are not able to do so. Now, I don't have no evidence to show they are doing that for the presidential election of 2020. So we are still waiting to know where they are going and how far are they ready to go.
That's Jean Gervasi Chichedi speaking with VOA's James Batty. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at Australian asylum laws. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who motivates you?
My mom, because she tells me what is right and what is wrong, what I'm supposed to follow. That's why she's my motivator.
I would say my dad, because I see him as my role model. He's very hardworking, and he makes sure that when he sets his mind to do something, he does it.
Well, for me, no one motivates me, but I motivate myself. Well, I can't say anyone, but I can say myself, because for me, I'm really talented. I have so many things I can do.
Very many things motivates me in my life, my business, my place of work. It gives me courage, yeah. What motivates me most is my family, like my children, how I'm going to bring them up, their education. Those are the areas I look much more for.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Australia says it will no longer detain children in its migrant camp on the Pacific island of Nauru. The last remaining group of four children is preparing to fly to the United States with their families as part of a 2016 resettlement deal with Washington. From Sydney, Phil Massey reports.
In August, there were more than 100 children held on Nauru. Australia refused to resettle them under tough immigration policies meant to deter asylum seekers arriving by sea. Critics said the young detainees were being damaged for life and there was intense pressure on the minority government in Parliament. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has confirmed that children will no longer be detained on Nauru, although several hundred adult detainees remain on the island. Morrison said his administration had stopped asylum boats and had prevented tragic drownings at sea. He's also conceding ground on the controversial issue of transferring refugees to Australia for medical treatment. A new independent panel of medical experts will review any decision by immigration authorities to refuse to allow sick and injured detainees from offshore camps in the South Pacific to Australia for treatment. The concession is a bid by the Prime Minister to prevent a humiliating defeat on the issue in Parliament next week. Independent Federal MP Karen Phelps says the government has been slow to act.
The only reason that children have been removed from detention is because of community pressure. The government was keeping children there for 5 years or more without any hope of a future of freedom or safety until the community put pressure on them. And now we're seeing that the medical profession is needing to step up along with refugee advocates to say the medical situation on Manus Island Nauru is unacceptable and needs to change.
Australia has detained asylum seekers arriving by sea on the tiny Republic of Nauru since the facility was reopened in 2012. Another Australian-run facility at Manus Island in Papua New Guinea closed in October 2017. Although several hundred refugees and asylum seekers remain on the island in community accommodation, their futures are uncertain. Since 2013, the Australian Navy has been ordered to tow or turn back migrant boats. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A new report says the world produces at least 50 million tons of electronic waste each year, and that number is expected to double 30 years from now. The impact of all that electronic junk is specially felt in Africa. Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Mobile phones are increasingly common gadgets across Africa. You can get a phone for as little as $10 in the streets of Nairobi. Most Kenyans, however, don't know how to safely dispose of their old phones when they get a new one.
I have a spoiled phone. I've kept it at home. Maybe for future use, or maybe I can decide to dispose it. Yeah, one day. Mostly if it's not working, I can decide just to throw it away. It depends on how it has spoiled. I throw it away.
It is this kind of behavior that has environmentalists concerned, as many phones, once thrown away, end up in rivers and oceans. The UN Environmental Programme estimates that 50 million tons of electronic waste was produced in 2018. It says that number could climb to 120 million tons by the year 2050. One half of so-called e-waste comprises personal devices like computers, smartphones and tablets. Simon Omengo uses an orthodox means to dispose of his electronic gadgets.
Since its motherboard failed, then automatically I disposed. I threw it in the dust in the toilet. I burn it. I break it into pieces because it's useless now to me.
Winnie says the government needs to come up with ways to safely dispose of old devices.
For our government to come up with a place where we can take all the gadgets, especially the phones, which are spoiled, we go and dispose them there, and then they'll know how they'll dispose them, rather than just scattering them around. Because some of the people, they just throw them in the dustbin, and it is a hazard to the environment.
Experts say electronic devices are becoming complicated to repair and some don't last long. With more devices being thrown away, one Kenya-based group, EnviroServe, is trying to change how Africa's e-waste is managed by stripping down reusable metals and plastics from phones. Some materials remain in Kenya, while other parts like batteries are shipped abroad. Sean Mumford, the head of the company, says old phones were simply dumped in Kenya for years.
It wasn't necessarily being done in a way that is useful, and also it was staying here. So what we're able to do is, instead of Africa being a dumping ground, which has historically, you know, been the case, we're able to deal with what makes sense here and send back out the country the things that need to be dealt with properly.
More than half the population is under the age of 30, and the demand for the latest electronics and dumping the old ones is only growing. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This morning, Zimbabweans woke up to read about a major price hike for bread, which is a staple food. That follows a fuel price increase 3 weeks ago that set off 3 days of protest. The Zimbabwean government is grappling to manage a country besieged by strikes precipitated by a struggling economy. VOA's Adi Gondo gives us more on that story.
The price of bread has jumped by about 70%, the fourth increase in the last year. A loaf that was selling at $1.40 now goes for between $2.10 to $2.50 in a move that citizens are greeting with chagrin. It's the biggest increase since 2009 and the first of the new year. Last November, the government held lengthy negotiations with the National Bakers Association of Zimbabwe, NBAZ, the umbrella body representing the interests of local bakers. They had proposed to push the price of bread to $2.20, but government vetoed the proposal at the time, demanding to know what could be done to keep the price at levels affordable by the ordinary citizen. Economic analyst Reginald Shoko speaks on the issue.
I think bread was going to increase, just as a follow-up to the increase of fuel, and also the fact that there has been a surge in terms of demand of bread. If you have realized in the past week, bread had no stable price, especially in the items in the suburb. It was now like the highest bidder takes it all. The price of bread could go and sell as $4, as high as $4. So it's just responding to the effect of the artificial high demand caused by the closure of shops and also the increase in petrol that has led to higher demand, which is artificial in nature because it's not supported by anything. Remember, the wheat flour prices have not gone up. So it's the issue of petrol.
Observers say the reason behind the bread shortages could also be down to the close of shops which used to retail the bread and the knock-on effect that increases demand and therefore the prices. Alice Moyo is a 40-year-old mother of 6 children who feels the bitter taste of the bread increases.
Bread increase is affecting us very hard because as for me, I've got 6 children at home. I can't afford, I'm supposed to buy 3 loaves. So as for now, I can't even one, it can't. $2.50 from $1.50. It just came from a dollar. Just a few months, it's $1.50. Another month, is now $2.50. So it's very hard. We'll go back home to rural areas, I think, very soon.
Young people in Zimbabwe feel a sense of despair with government's inability to turn the economy around. Mandla Ncube expresses his frustration.
All right, I think it's just an addition to the things which government is not dealing with, which should be dealt with. You know, bread is an everyday commodity, and I think it should be easily accessible and cheap. So they should do something about it. That's too expensive. Actually, a dollar was already too expensive. So at $2.50, it's extreme. It means a lot of people are going to cut on bread and find an alternative, which is not right. They are not governing anything, actually. They're just there.
The National Bakers Association and the relevant ministry could not be reached in time for comment. The government has in the past shifted the blame to retailers, alleging that they are taking advantage of the situation to profiteer. The prices of basic commodities have been going up due to the country's currency crisis. The increase in fuel prices by about 150% on January 12th worsened the situation as retailers have noted the higher costs of business. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The SPLA in opposition says it will send the first batch of nearly 4,000 soldiers to a South Sudanese cantonment site in Yei River State this weekend. The SPLA-IO, other opposition forces, and government troops are preparing to be trained together in the Payam of Kandela to eventually serve as one unified army. SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampaul Gabriel and a member of the Joint Defense Board, which is responsible for implementing security arrangements in the revitalized peace agreement, confirm that the parties have all agreed to open the cantonment site on February 10th. Gabriel says after talking about cantonment sites for about a month, the Joint Defense Board has agreed that the SPLA-IO forces will be trained to protect civilians and politicians once a new government of national unity is formed in May of this year. The first South Sudan court-martial of an army general got underway today. Major General Stephen Bui Rolinyang, a former commander of the Army's 5th Division in Wau, was arrested in his village in Mayim County, a former Unity State, back in May. He's accused of treason and other charges for failing to report to headquarters in Juba as ordered by his senior officers. Bui's defense lawyer, Philip Anyang, argued today that the military court should have been formed by President Salva Kiir, as he is commander-in-chief, and not by the head of South Sudan's armed forces. He says the defense will not compromise on any procedural issues that infringe on his client's rights. And finally, Australia says it will no longer detain children in its migrant camp on the Pacific island of Nauru. The last group of four children is getting ready to fly to the United States with their families as part of a 2016 resettlement deal with Washington. In August, there were more than 100 children held on Nauru. Australia refused to resettle them under strict immigration policies that were meant to deter asylum seekers arriving by sea. Critics say the young detainees were being damaged for life and that the minority government in parliament was facing intense pressure to change the law. Prime Minister Scott Morrison confirmed that children will no longer be detained on Nauru, but several hundred adult detainees will remain on the island. Morrison says his administration had stopped asylum boats and had prevented what he calls tragic drownings at sea. He is also conceding ground on the controversial issue of transferring refugees to Australia for medical treatment. A new independent panel of medical experts will review any decision by immigration authorities to refuse to allow sick and injured detainees from offshore camps in the South Pacific to Australia for medical treatment. The concession is a bid by the Prime Minister to prevent a humiliating defeat on the issue in Parliament next week. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song I Am Peace by a group calling itself I Am Peace Ambassador.
I am the light shining bright in your eyes.
I am the voice whispering gently in your ear.
I am the hope that tomorrow is assured.
That forever we will stand side by side.
Anasalam, salam.
Intasalam,
salam.
Anina salam,
salam.
I am peace, I am peace, I am.
Anasalam,
salam.
Intasalam,
salam.
Anina salam,
salam.
I am peace, I am peace, I am peace.
Mapi Sultan Barum Salam, Salam Yao Sultan Nesia. Kanita bees the Wajataku, Deyahu Salam. Salam Mapi Madam Fi Waraka, Salam de Tifagia Fi Golumna. Nabdahi Bubadu, Deyahu Salam.
Mapi Zira, Benut Salam, Mapi Giraya, Benut Salam.
This is not about signing the paper. This is not about hating each other. This is you, this is me, this is us. This is all about forgiving each other.
We have been listening to a group calling itself I Am Peace Ambassadors with the song I Am Peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
From the moon to the sunrise, together we can shine bright. You and me, we can do love this nation. Kozana, uita ya salam. Silama bijibu salam. Kila ni